Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2020. This is the final stream on this, the ninth night of Millennial. And this is with a very hotly anticipated guest who I get requested for. People ask for this guy every year and he obliges every year, which is very kind. It's the Distributist. Welcome, Distributist, to Millennial.
Well, thank you very much. You're making me blush. I'm not somebody who takes compliments well. I always feel kind of nervous as if you're talking about somebody else. But yeah, thank you very much for having me on. It's always great to have these little traditions that go on in the YouTube community. And I think this is one of the best ones that goes on because you can see what everyone on the right is, and sometimes even on the left, are really doing at the end of a year. And yeah, I think 2020 is one of those years where people really are curious what everyone's take on the last 12 months is going to be.
Oh, for sure. And, you know, you mentioned on the left as well. I'd like to have lefties on, but, you know, they won't do it. So it's a shame. But I'd be perfectly, you know, just if anyone's watching, you know, I'm not averse to that. And I am quite a nice guy. You know, I won't be horrible to you. Yeah, seriously, I mean, you know, I'm not going to attack you if you want to come on. It'd be quite interesting.
Didn't you have that weird lefty a long time ago? He had that really long neck or whatever. Oh, Isaacson, I think was his last name.
Yes, it was 2017.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, it was certainly an interesting encounter.
That was a different time altogether, for sure.
Yeah, it definitely was. I mean, you and I have been are sort of veterans at this point. I mean, I've been going since 2014. But when did you start your channel?
I started my channel in 2016. And
right, okay.
Yeah, I was mainly criticizing Sargon, and during that time, I think I myself went through a lot of transformations. I went from being sort of a more vaguely right-wing person to being somebody who had more explicit reactionary sympathies, and by reactionary, I mean sort of the intellectual school of reaction and NRX. A lot of the stuff that happened in 2016 forced me to go back to authors like, you know, Nick Land and Moldbug and reevaluate them. Because a lot of the things that I thought were politically real in 2015 turned out to be, well, obvious mirages. And I think we're in another one of those places in 2020. I guess this is just going to happen every 4 years, but this is indeed, you know, what we're having here is a sea change in how we think about politics. And I think it's kind of interesting because I think NRX, and I hope I'm not going on too much, I think NRX is in some ways...
No, don't worry about that. It's delightful to hear your thoughts.
NRX has had sort of its best year on record and its worst year on record. Give me some rope here. This is sort of how the year started, was that the one of the NRX celebrities, Curtis Yarvin, started writing again, indeed started writing a book, which was really exciting. And it was, you know, somewhat more or less a rehashing and a solidification of his ideas that appeared on his blog. Really, I think the blog ended 8 years ago. But then, you know, in addition to that, all of these political things started happening. The COVID, obviously, the election, the George Floyd protests. And it seemed for a second that every one of these happenings basically confirmed the neo-reactionary model of politics. All the predictions neo-reaction made about how politics did or could work inside actual political stress more or less came true. Okay, so pretty good so far, right? Then, you know, what's so odd is that everyone kind of had this huge surge of interest in neo-reaction in the spring and the summer. Then around the election
You start, could you explain what you mean that the predictions of NRX with regard to politics, and what do you mean by that? Could you be specific?
Okay.
What are predictions about how it works and how were they proven right?
Okay, so the idea of sort of NRX is that we essentially are ruled by a cultural consensus. And this cultural consensus, let's talk about what it means to rule first off. I hope I'm not digressing too much. but I'm going to kind of defer to Carl Schmitt, who is, I would call him sort of a core reactionary author. He was a German during the Third Reich. I'm sure that kind of makes him reactionary. But he said that one of his famous sayings was that, you know, real political power, or, you know, ultimate political power, which we call sovereignty, by who decides the exception. And that's a famous Schmittian construction. And the other thing we can see from reactionary theory is that what really matters is who controls the narrative. So on paper, who rules us is Congress, the president, you know, perhaps a few unelected officials like the Supreme Court. But we saw in 2020 that basically based on media constructions, the apparatus of the United States government combined with the academy, combined with the media, combined with places like the CDC and the World Health Organization could effectively wield almost unlimited power on people's lives to an extent that you could hardly believe was possible previously. And not only could it wield basically such extremes of political power I couldn't have really imagined it before 2020, it also cut exceptions for itself. For instance, you know, I have a new child, and a lot of the summer was us trying to take him out. And a few times in the spring and in the summer, we tried to take him to the beach, which I know maybe in England, this is sort of a classic family excursion expedition in America, right? Go to the beach with the baby or something like that. Right.
Yeah.
And so
we would say the seaside.
Well, yeah, the seaside, but okay. Yeah. Well, in the state I live in, the seasides were considered to be an extreme risk, for spreading COVID. There's a vast coast in the state I live in, which is California.
There's probably a joke here about a second wave.
Okay, yes. but you know, basically, the reason why the beaches were closed is that a few people over the American spring break had taken these pictures where people spread out, you know, 12 feet apart from each other, because it was shot in profile, looked like they were all packed in, right? So because of that narrative that beaches were spreading COVID, the authorities across many states just closed down public beaches for no reason. I mean, or ostensibly because of COVID, right? And so then we move into May. And these same officials essentially cooperate when I think that, you know, walking along a beach, you know, 1/12th of a mile away from a person way down with a cool ocean breeze and a saline solution in between you and the next person, that's a super spreader event. But having entire cities taken over by anarchist mobs and then packing into these general assemblies where they're all shouting at each other and voting on things and protesting loudly, this might actually stop the spread of COVID. So you see, basically sort of the two sides of neo-reactionary theory, predictively speaking, right, come true. A, power is predominantly controlled, wielded, and contained in institutions that are not official, that are beneath the surface, right? I know other people have different ways of talking about this, and every now and again, conservatives will try to point their finger at this object. For reactionaries, we've always called this the cathedral, which you might as well just say is the informational apparatus of our society, the information management apparatus of our society, which is unofficial and which controls the narratives that rule our lives. The second thing is that basically, when power is in operation, you can always tell its power by the fact that it cuts exceptions to its own rules. And so you could really see how power was operating, not only necessarily during the COVID times, but also in this election period. Power basically did what it wanted to and then came up with a narrative explanation after the fact, retroactively. And it worked perfectly fine for the most part.
Yes, well, this has been a big deal this year. We've watched power, as you use your noun, just create its own narrative, insist on that narrative, and not face any real opposition. I mean, it's been completely unimpeded in spreading a narrative, which in multiple narratives, which have been obviously flawed, if not fallacious. And Power has been able to do that. And even when it's obvious, like, there must be, like, just rationally, how can it be okay to do a BLM demo, but an anti-COVID demo is breaching social distancing protocols? That doesn't make sense at all.
It makes absolutely no sense, right? Like, why can't you go to the beach when people are locking down five neighborhoods of the most densely populated area of the state, holding massive protests? It makes absolutely no sense, but we were asked to play ball with this. I mean, you could go to our governor, Gavin Newsom. He basically canceled Thanksgiving and then the next day went out to a big fancy dinner with a bunch of his donors in public.
Yes. Yes. And again, that's another thing, is the shamelessness of the hypocrisy. Because these people are so powerful that they don't even care whether they're found out. It's just a joke, really.
I know most people in Britain probably will be thinking, oh, Thanksgiving, what is that? Just a day off. My wife, who's Canadian, she regards it the same way, as just another, you know, day off or something. But for Americans, canceling Thanksgiving is roughly equivalent to canceling Christmas, right?
Well, our prime minister just did that, so we're in the same boat.
Him, Gavin Newsom, and the White King from C.S. Lewis's The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe all are infamous Christmas cancelers at this stage. But what's sort of funny about this is that, and I'm not complaining about this at all, but I noticed that just as sort of the predictive realities of the NRX ideas were coming to fruition, people started really souring on it in sort of October, November. And I think what really happened was that sort of the insight that NRX was providing became obvious to a large degree. So there wasn't that much utility out of pointing out the obvious. And furthermore, sort of the weaker areas of neo-reactionary theory, which are the prescriptions of what to do, of which there are basically none that are serious, the absence of that became very, very apparent. And I think this is sort of...
So now the situation you predicted has come about. So now what do you have to say about what we should do about it? And the answer is not much at all.
Well, I mean, you know, it's not that kind of a thing. The point of neo-reactionary theory is to describe how a system operates, not to tell you how to change it necessarily. I suppose understanding how it operates is the first step. And I noticed this, but this is, I think, part of a larger crisis on the right. And this is that no one really has very many good ideas of what to do. And I don't mean this in, like, you know, obviously I and you and anyone listening can go and do something positive, either for our communities or for a counter-progressive position generally. But we don't have any, I'm kind of borrowing another neo-reactionary term, we don't really have any of what Gaetano Mosca would call political formulas that work. Now, a political formula, so Gaetano Mosca was this an Italian reactionary thinker in the early 20th century who came up with this idea of a political formula, which by he meant generally a narrative that sort of justifies you wielding power. So all political institutions have political formulas. The way I use it here is a little bit more specific, which means a political formula to me is like a political business model. A business model is a set of actions that you do so that at the end of the day, you have more money than what you started with, or at the end of the cycle. And if that doesn't work, you don't have a working business model. The problem with the right now is that it has actions that it can do that will advance its agenda. But those actions don't actually buttress any kind of power apparatus that supports the right. So the left has tons of political formulas. And maybe we can talk about some of them because it's kind of funny how well they work. But the left has tons of political formulas where you can just take the behavior and do it. And you don't have to think and you don't have to continuously supply money to it. And it naturally generates you both wealth and prestige and power. And at the same time, advances the left-wing political cause. There are very few ways where you can net yourself any kind of prestige or power and advance the political right cause. Hence, you know, in the more specific way that I use it, the right doesn't have any political formulas that really work for it.
Well, what I would say about this, just off the cuff, mm-hmm. is that the left has political formulas today, yes, and they work, yes, of course they do. But I think that that's to a large extent dependent on the environment in which they're operating in, because namely, it's a very sympathetic environment because it's been made that way over the last 100 years. So it's sympathetic. It's ready to accept those formulas, those narratives, and to work.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's acceptant of them. So whereas it's not acceptant of ours because it's not designed to be, it's not supposed to be. I don't know. And again, that doesn't get us closer to a solution, but it does, I think, isolate the problem and perhaps give us some scope. Because
I can see people in the chat asking me for an example. A great example of this is Destiny. I mean, you know, the YouTuber Destiny, right? Or the, I guess she's a Twitch streamer, right?
Yes, I know Destiny, yeah.
Yeah. So people react to Destiny like he's a person. And no, he is, and he's kind of ridiculous, and a lot of his ideas are stupid. But people didn't realize when they saw Destiny in 2017 is the real thing about Destiny is that he wasn't really a person. He was a thing you could do online and get clout for yourself. Because since 2017, and people have done this to a ridiculous extent, people have been cloning Destiny's business model down to the very expressions he uses, from Destiny to Vosh to the thousands and thousands of Destiny Vosh clones that are overwhelming the Twitch and YouTube stream right now. Every one of them talks the same way, they frame the same way, and they play the same kind of game that Destiny does. And it works. It works like a charm.
But what is that game that he plays?
Well, what Destiny does, and Destiny does this is slightly different than Vosh, and it's a slightly different game, so I hope I don't digress this. What Destiny does is he positions himself not to argue for some position he believes in, but so that it's the hardest possible. It's hard to narratively argue against him. So he'll take positions that are very popular with the Academy, or narratives that are very popular with the Academy, and he'll argue those. The other thing he'll do is he'll always shift the burden. Basically, he'll always pose himself as the neutral position and you as the person who's intruding upon his neutral position and needs to provide credentials. Then all he does is simply reframe, and ask for more evidence. And eventually the person taps, and then he can portray them as if they're a charlatan who's been exposed. Right. And that's, of course, the affectation is that after the person taps out and isn't able to refute the sixth paper that Destiny has ready to go on his position, then all of a sudden Destiny affects exasperation and bafflement at how stupid or unprepared this position is. And, you know, this sort of cues a collective reaction in his audience. Vosh, who's the first Destiny clone, realized that you could copy this and do it even further to the left, and it would work even better. And you know, these people, by all descriptions, their positions rhetorically and their personal lives are a total mess. Half of Vosh's ideas are provably wrong and are insane. One of his frequently argued positions are that trans women are not at an advantage in women's sporting competitions against biological women. This is easy to refute. Their personal lives are horrific and depressing if you look into them.
Let's not get into the personal stuff because it's dodgy. It makes it look like we're arguing in bad faith.
Oh, and of course, I don't intend to, but that's, I think, sort of a pertinent detail because it's sort of universally a quality of these clones. And in addition to that, I think I'm still here. In addition to that, they've said things, both Destiny, mostly Vosh, they said things that should have gotten them banned from YouTube and Twitch a thousand times over. Right after I talked to Vosh last year, he went on the air and argued for 1 hour that we should genocide tribes of native hunter and gatherers because they're xenophobic and don't want people to immigrate to where they live. He's advocated for.
See, that reminds me, I haven't seen Star Trek Discovery, but I was told that the first two episodes, it might even have been you. Somebody did a video about it, and I've been meaning to watch it ever since, because apparently, I watched the video, but I haven't seen the two episodes. Apparently, the first two episodes of Star Trek Discovery are essentially that progressive Starfleet essentially says that a population should be genocided because they're not progressive enough.
Oh, really? I haven't seen that, but this will be the same argument, right?
Yes, it's the Vosh protocol.
That's what you should call it. The Vosh genocide for progress. But you know, this guy has said horrible things that by any regular standard should get him banned. He obviously doesn't, right? Because there is this understanding here. So what he does works. And if you duplicate it, it could work for you. So this becomes a successful political formula, a successful way to prop up what these people do in public. And this is sort of the core problem, I think, with the right, is we have a very good set of arguments. Our ability to predict how institutions of power work are very effective. I think they've shown themselves to be very effective this year. But we don't have a set of political formulas that work. We don't have a way of interacting with the mainstream that doesn't cost us a lot and doesn't really give anything back to the communities that interact that way. I think we're still in search of something like that. And it's my opinion that the right is going to have to undertake some radical transformations in 2021 and 2022. And it's going to have to emerge as something much, much more broad and much, much, much more broad and also much deeper. In the sense that it cares about things, it cares about ideas that extend beyond just the crude politics at the top level.
Yes, that's one thing that I'll go into first before I go into the other bit. Mm-hmm. I think you're absolutely right. The left carries with it this sense of virtue and morality that the politics, the individual policies that they might advocate are one thing. But they're just tools in the name of a cause, and the cause is social justice. The cause is equality. The cause is articulated in various ways, or progress, fairness, of course, and prosperity as well, because we all love prosperity. So it's, and I don't know, you could go into it more deeply even than that, but that's what underlies all of the stuff about the police needs redevelopment, reformation, and the education system needs to be overhauled, and all the rest of it. But what underlies that is this crusade, a moral crusade to change the world, to transform the world. The right does not want to transform the world. And I think or doesn't profess that it wants to change the world.
I think that might be a mistake, actually.
Hmm? Go on.
I think that might be a mistake. I think the right does need to want to transform the world. Oh, yes. We need to want a future.
Yes.
We need to desperately love a future that we're not getting.
Yes.
And I've, you know, I'm sort of known as the traditionalist because I subscribe to a traditional morality and religion and social mores. But I've become really sick of this whole, I'm not sick of it. I mean, I understand the motivation and it's true, but the aesthetic of return to tradition, the sort of casting back to things that are native and comfortable. I kind of want to balance this out with something else that the imagines future. A way of moving forward into the future.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I completely agree. Because I think that, you know, the thing about the trad wife, trad family, trad morals, it's all very well and good. I think it's jargon-esque, which is one problem with it. It's sort of a semi-ironic thing, the girl in the wheat field, all that stuff.
Yeah.
But I also think it's a bit unrealistic because we are all products of modernity, and I think there's a large degree of an untenable amount of LARPing involved in this. Now, some LARPing is fine because it's fake it till you make it kind of thing, but this is too much of a reach. We're talking about people, Zoomers, Millennials, even Gen X, who are really fucked up by modernity. And for them to say, well, I'm aspiring to this, a very small number of them will manage it. A much larger number will screw up. And I know, I've seen it. It happens because we are, it's unrealistic. Now, that's not to say that's not the end of the matter. I'm not saying that these aren't worthy goals. I'm saying that we should be more honest about what is possible there. But the other thing is, as you say, it's the trad thing is fine. I'm not against traditionalism, and I do think that traditionalism or traditional ideas, morals, whatever, it's largely the accumulation of wisdom that's been very painfully and painstakingly gathered over the centuries and over the millennia. So I don't think it's something to be sniffed at. I don't think it's just a bunch of, you know, dusty old ideas that were largely the products of ignorance or whatever. I have a lot of veneration for them. I think that, yes, they are hard won. They're not just stupid things, assumptions. I don't have a problem with them in and of themselves, these traditional morals and so on. But again, it even feels morbid to be that tied to the past in that sense, a sort of doctrinaire sense. I think it's wrong. I think there's not enough talking about the future. There's not enough imagining futures. There's not enough of a sense of possibility and creation and innovation on the right. And there never has been. I mean, the nearest you'd get to it is the fast wave aesthetic, but that's
still nostalgia, right?
It's still nostalgia, and it's also quite limited. It's quite, it's not, yeah, and you're right, it's still nostalgia, ironically. It's still nostalgia for the 80s, and I like it. I love that aesthetic, but it's still not enough, and I really think that, you know, if you look about the left, I always think we should look to what our opponents did. And basically copy them, their tactics, as much as we can, or as much as we can bear to. What I was going to say was that they imagined the future. They imagined a future, and then they built it, and because they believed in it and were able to persuade other people to believe in that future. And that's fundamentally, that's one of the ways in which they got the public on board. Now, there's more to it than that, and that gets me to the second thing I was going to say, but you can react to that.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, what the left wants to do is they want to bring us into the dynamic of we're the future, they're the past. And what we really want to say to people like Vosh and Destiny and all these people, I'm not even like in a rhetorical sense, just in an emotional sense. Like, but even if I didn't hear any arguments from Vosh or Destiny, I would just want to say to them in an emotional sense, the life that you promise me in the future is just ugly. It's really, really ugly. It's the existence of the bug man. The bug man has no past. He has no connection to deeper roots. And going forward, he has no purpose to exist beyond. He has no purpose to exist beyond his own pleasure and beyond getting dopamine hits. This is never explicitly part of it, but this is more or less what Destiny and Vosh sell. They sell a politics that does not require the people who are listening to them, who are trapped in a bugman lifestyle. It does not require them to move, and in many ways justifies their existence in what frankly is a depressing existence and an incredibly ugly perspective future, which only promises a doubling down of this existence. Does anyone believe that 2020, like the plan that we're on right now, involves us living more authentic lives attached to a community and a land? leave aside any of the cultural stuff that we argue about, just those two basic facts. Everyone knows it's not heading in that direction. And Bosch and Destiny, I think their audience understands that this is the politics. This is the politics of living in pods and saying goodbye to anything that might be meaningful outside of simulated pleasure.
Yeah. I mean, the type of man, the type of person that they seem to envision as an ideal is really just an accidental manifestation of genetics on the continuum. It could have been anything. It turned out this way. It turned out that way. It turns out this way. And here he is going through some sensory experiences that have been created for him just to keep him amused. And then he's dead now. That's it. It's like a 70-80 year span of simulated sensation and biological amusement. It's just nothingness.
And politics is managing that existence while maximizing pleasure and minimizing pain. That's yes. How people see politics. The expression I want to say is that this is just squalid. Yes. And any future that I want to work towards is not going to be that future.
Yes, it's squalid. That's a good word for it. I think it's depressing. It's nihilistic. It's just the only good thing you can say. But the only positive thing is, well, at least there would be sensory pleasures. Mm-hmm. Yes, there would, but there'd be a complete dearth, complete absence of meaning. And this is what it always amazes me when you see people like Destiny and Vosh. They seem to be completely happy with that. They seem to be quite content with just an existence that has no meaning. They're almost like perfect consumers. It's like they've been prepared for that. They are the result of 200 years of, well, longer than that, of industrial progress, and you end up with this. You end up with this guy who just wants, is happy just to consume product.
Play a video game, and then own the chuds who are looking for something beyond that or for any kind of connection. Because since they don't have the proper academic sources to justify their connection, nor the academic bullshit to justify a preference beyond the life that you live, then you can own them and it becomes an entertainment product in and of itself. I think the future of the right is in discovering a type of politics that is not a consumer product. Now, I'm not so sure how to make that some kind of political formula, but
There's a comment here that it promises them eternal childhood. And I think that's a very perceptive comment about what they want. And I don't like to speak for Vosh and Destiny. They're not here. But I think that, to me, that's what it looks like. It looks like just comfort, safety, luxury, and novelties, endless novelty.
Well, I mean, I was just in a debate a few weeks ago with one of these Vosh clones. And in that debate, they were arguing that children should be fully autonomous members of society and have equal power against their parents, because there's nothing, given our technological advancement, their argument was there's nothing that a parent does that differentiates them from a child. And therefore, they should be as equals. And essentially, they're commending sort of a reality where we get rid of the nuclear family and consider sort of all people equally dependent on this collective apparatus. They didn't say state because that's a no-no word for the left, right? But essentially some overarching apparatus of management would essentially take care of adults and children. Regardless of age, you'd be on an equal ground. And this is how they got around the fact that, they're egalitarians even when it comes down to age differentials.
Yeah, I mean, that does have rather sinister possibilities there. Yeah, that to pedophilia and so on. It's pretty dark.
I'm sure that's eventually where it's going if it's not there already, right?
Yeah. The other thing I wanted to say was that it does remind what you've just said about the state protecting everyone, looking after everyone equally, and raising everyone. That was obviously under certain manifestations of communism, that was the idea, that the party raises every child. The every child is essentially the son or daughter of the party. And I think that what we're approaching is more like the some corporation, which, and I don't know where, this is something that's yet to be seen, so I don't want to make a mistake by predicting how it'll play out, because I'll almost certainly get it wrong. But I can see a situation in the future, not that distant, where a corporation is not, where everyone is raised by the corporation, and it's not so much that the corporation is responsible for a particular service in life, your Twitter, your social media, or your water supply or something, but it's actually almost like a private government, where it's in charge of everything essentially in one area, and so you'd have like Google, whatever, Microsoft, actually being the government of that part of the world, that region, because that.
Well, this is another reactionary prediction that has kind of come true in the last few years, largely that the government corporate distinction is more or less on a continuum, and that continuum is gamed in order to allow power to operate freely sometimes and be restricted in other ways.
Yes, exactly, because we don't really know what are the levers behind Twitter and behind Facebook and the World Economic Forum and so on. It seems to me that we're heading into an age where there's either infinite money or corporations' powers can operate as if they have infinite money. There was a thing.
Well, we were discussing this thing. I think that's not going to happen. I think that's the great lie. If they have infinite money, then it's game over, right? I mean, that's if someone can generate infinite money, they can generate infinite power and infinite will.
Well, they could enslave a population into debt, multi-generational debt slavery. Yeah. So that effectively would be an infinite supply of money. Just off the cuff. I'm not I haven't looked into this, but there was a thing recently, and I believe it turned out to be a conspiracy theory, possibly one deliberately engineered in order to discredit people who were objecting to the Great Reset. But it was a thing about a government meeting, some fairly low-level government meeting in Canada, where and it was an account of this meeting, where apparently something called the World Debt Reset Program was going to clear the debt of everyone in Canada, but in return they had to give up their private property, and including their houses and so on.
Yeah, I mean this is what really comes down to the Great Reset thing, and this is kind of where I want to repossess this language. I don't think the question is that we're going to undergo some Great Reset. I think the question is who gets reset. Because I would love to reset the World Economic Forum. I would love to reset the IMF. I would love to reset Google and Twitter. But
yes.
You notice in all of this Great Reset stuff, there are some people who are going to get reset and some people who aren't. And the people who are going to be reset are always the middle, upper middle, and lower middle class, and sometimes lower class. And the thing that's going to preserve its narrative structure and its informational structure indefinitely are the large bank databases and the large managerial databases and large managerial and bank elites that stands above the entire apparatus of debt.
Yeah, exactly. And this, I mean, this thing, this account of a government meeting, as I say, I think it's turned out to be a sort of hoax. And I wouldn't be surprised if it was deliberately engineered in order to make anyone who objects to the Great Reset look like a tinfoil hat wearer. So I'm not going to say that it's real, that this thing about the World Debt Reset Program. I don't think it is. But
yeah.
But it was plausible. And that's the thing. It felt I could imagine it being real. If not now, if not next year, then 10 years from now. 20 years.
They've spitballed these. I mean, that thing might have been a hoax, but they've spitballed those ideas before in the past. I know that the Franklin has commented on this. I've seen these articles where they publish something in a journal, usually something like the Atlantic, And the article will run something like, in the future, you'll own nothing and have access to everything. And it, you know, it's this positive puff piece of a paper that came out of one of these think tanks or an NGO like the World Economic Forum. I don't know. I mean, this is, they're always going to call this a conspiracy theory, even though we know specific people who talk like this and write these articles and commend this and so on and so forth. I think a lot of it we bring on ourselves because we talk about it in stupid ways. But a lot of it's just informational control. They can decide the narrative that's going to go on top of these things. So they do.
Yeah, of course. And that's happened for quite a few years now with, I don't think I can afford even to mention specific things, but something has obviously been real. But by talking about it, you get accused of being a conspiracy theorist. It's quite incredible. But anyway, so what would you say about this possibility of a future where effectively, well, I mean, something like the World Debt Reset Program wouldn't be a corporation as such. It wouldn't be a private corporation, but it would also have no democratic accountability whatsoever. I mean, it reminded me, because I was thinking about this, that there was one line in that account was, we were told that the World Debt Reset Program would handle all of the details. And that reminded me of Twitter. Some people think I'm obsessed with the fact that I was once banned from Twitter. I'm honestly not. It's 2 years ago now. I don't really care. In fact, I really don't care at this point. But that leaving that aside, one of the things that I noticed was in more recent exchanges with Twitter, if you complain to Twitter about something, the email you get back will be a completely boilerplate reply, and then it will say, thank you, Twitter. It'll be signed Twitter, the name of the corporation, not an individual within the court, not someone that you can name and go to and cite as a reference or whatever. It's just the corporation. It's the entire corporation is talking to you. The entire machine is talking to you, and you have no idea what that actually means. And I thought, when I read the World Debt Reset Program will handle all of the details, I thought, I bet it reminded me of that, where you would be interacting with a massive, completely unaccountable machine, where there would be no human contact, really. And that seems, again, it seems plausible to me.
So I guess I kind of lost track of the question, because is the question, was my reaction to this possibility, or?
Yes.
Okay. I mean, so leaving aside whether this specific thing you're talking about is a hoax or real, we know that there's real equivalence, at least in theory, when they talk about these things and write articles. There's basically two possibilities. The first possibility is that these people actually have infinite money. They actually do have a corner on all the world's information, and this is imminently going to be, these two facets are imminently going to be linked together in the form of super intelligence through artificial intelligence. If that's the case, which I consider a very rare possibility, it's pretty much game over, except for people who just want to shrink power structures down to the point where this godlike powerful entity is not going to care, or it's not going to be worth its time to pursue them, right? But I think that's a very, very remote possibility, that they just have everything completely sewn up, and this is more or less a victory lap. I think and I think that what's going on, and what's much more likely going on, is that the elites are desperate. They see that what they're planning on is not going to come about, and these concepts of having infinite money and post-scarcity economy are more or less pipe dreams. That the only thing they can rely on, because they're more realistic dreams of a common market and an EU that was constantly expanding, liberal social democracy or liberal progressive social democracy, that obviously isn't happening the way they thought. So they have to cook up this fantasy that they might actually try to work towards it, but as it were, being able to implement this in any way that's not going to explode in their faces, I think that's, I find that harder to believe it's going to happen.
So to be clear, the social democracy as we've known it for the last 20 or 30 years, that is failing, because the idea was that it would spread all over. The idea was that it would spread all over the world. That's not happening. Therefore, they're cooking.
So their markets are not expanding anymore, right?
Right. So that,
and that's a big thing for them.
Yes. So therefore, they've cooked up the fantasy of the Great Reset. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, I'm spitballing here, right? Because we're trying to get in people's heads that we don't know, right? But the only way that they can make their worldview work is if you imagine them totally redesigning society so that they could sustain economic growth, and so that they could get rid of all of their nasty political problems that they don't have solutions for.
Right. And is it going? Go on.
Yeah, that's all I had to say. I mean, that's not all I have to say, but and this is the problem. Is I think their elites are working in a fantasy land. So this could result real. I mean, I don't want to overplay this, right? I don't want to make this sound like they're weak. They're very strong, and this fantasy world will result in real malice being enacted against the people that they think are standing in the way of their fantasy. But I don't think that this post-scarcity economy, human race managed by an AI with infinite money, I don't think that they actually have that in the bag. And I think that political circumstances are going to disrupt that plan. If they have it in the bag, then we have to discuss very different modes of human existence at that stage.
Yes. But, So let's assume that it's not going to work out for them. And this is just this is a fantasy. It's a sort of cope strategy. So then if we do nothing, like dissidents, the right, or dissidents of any stripe, if we do nothing, what will happen? Can you predict that? If you think that the elite's plan isn't going to work out, then why do we need to do anything?
Well, I mean, let's use the reactionary model here, right? So what we have essentially is a dying power apparatus that's bleeding power. That's basically what's happening, right? And all what's happening is all of these creatures are these third parties, these NGOs are hooking up to this dying apparatus and just lapping up the power. It's bleeding off. What will naturally happen, and I'm not making a prediction, I'm just, you know, talking about the sort of the physics, the Machiavellian physics of the situation, is that some alternative ruling organization is going to walk into the vacuum and start locking things down. Now, I think that without action from the right's goal should be to create the foundation for a political apparatus to do this that has the interests of Native peoples, of Western peoples, of and the visions of what I would consider Western telos and Western religions in mind. But eventually somebody is going to consolidate power. For instance, in this whole COVID lockdown fiasco, I would say that China, the Beijing faction in China, has taken large strides to consolidating their international power. Not necessarily in places you'd see in the West, but pretty much everywhere else.
So that's quite interesting, because of course they, I mean, I'm not going to blame the Chinese for the coronavirus, but it kind of did start with them, didn't it?
Well, I mean, you know, what you think there was never going to be a disease rate with, it spread like coronavirus and had a 99% survival rate. I want to be clear here, a lot of people, 99%, a lot of people are dying, right? Like a lot of people are dying, and that's very real. You can see it in the statistics, right? But this is not a historically rare occurrence. For instance, if any of the diseases that we eradicated due to antibiotics came back again, the result on our population would probably be worse than coronavirus. And antibiotics, I mean, we probably lived through a very historically unique time period where we didn't have diseases that would go around periodically that were highly contagious and had a 1% fatality rate.
Yes, indeed. I mean, there's nothing unusual. This is not some unprecedented thing. My comment about the coronavirus was just a sort of ironic point that China seems to have benefited the most out of all of this. So would you say then that the likes of Klaus Schwab are jokers. They're not actually, they don't actually have a plan that's going to work.
Well, I mean, this is where I would probably differ from people like Endeavor. What I see, when I look at our world leaders right now, I look at people who are in charge of a corporation that's dying and a business model that's dying. And what they're doing is they're just selling things. They're basically selling us all out. But they're selling us all out to perpetuate an illusion that the organization that they're in charge of is solvent, which it's currently not, unless the institutions that they run are completely redesigned. And
well, I guess that's why that, I mean, you could say that's why they've engineered all of this, that the hysteria around COVID, because that brings huge amounts of money into these institutions, doesn't it? At least in the case of Pfizer, in the case of the World Economic Forum. I mean, I'm sure that they must be benefiting from this, surely.
Oh yeah, I mean the people in charge of, well, I mean, depends on what organization, but there are a lot of winners from this. The CDC, the World Health Organization, now have broad powers that we have to acknowledge. And of course, they're all unofficial powers, right? They're all unofficial, but they're real in any realistic sense. They're real. They can exercise them.
Well, exactly. I see, this is a thing that I don't think that you're in danger of this. I'm just saying we shouldn't assume that this is about money, because at that level, it's power, and it's the pooling of power. It's not. I don't really think it's. I think money is sort of an afterthought for these people. I don't think they really care, because they can just add it to the debt.
But I don't think these people aren't going to get the world that they want. They're going to produce a chaotic world that the only salient feature of the new world they're producing is the necessity to eliminate them and take their place. And I think that if they were successful masterminds, this wouldn't be happening. If the cathedral were working properly, it wouldn't be visible. The fact that everyone can see it now means that something's gone seriously wrong with their plan.
So, okay. So can you explain to me, how can everyone see the cathedral now? What do you mean by that? How has it made itself? How has it betrayed itself? Because to me, it looks like Klaus Schwab is now a public figure and it hasn't changed anything. No one cares.
No, I think seeing the cathedral and doing something about it is two different things. The cathedral is just the informational and administrative apparatus of our civilization. The typical understanding of this, right, is that NGOs propose ideas. Those ideas go into the public. And then when the public decides that they're good, they vote on electors that execute those ideas, right? That's what's supposed to happen, right? Did that happen in 2020? No. What happened is that a bunch of NGOs and administrative organizations cooked up a plan. They didn't tell the public. There was no election. And then not only did the plan for confronting COVID go into effect with really no public discussion, the discussion of what to do after COVID was obviously decided and parroted by leaders, basically copying talking points from NGOs. And we all know that these guys won and dined together, right? But we have leaders like Justin Trudeau repeating NGO talking points.
Yes.
On an issue that was never discussed in public. There was no news program that discussed any of these ideas. It just appeared.
None of it.
Well, okay. So when I say that the cathedral is exposed, what I'm saying is that process from cause to effect, where the media, delivers facts to the public, and then the public delivers the election or the narrative and the election, and then the election delivers the administrative power. 2020 has demonstrated that the administrative power and the media and the academy can influence the government without any intermediary contact with the public or barely any.
Yeah.
And so that's what I say when I say it's been exposed. Now, I mean, I don't think this is – I think this is one thing that we've learned in 2020 is that, a lot of the right wing or the past, for the past 30 years, the distant right has been kind of talking about this moment where everyone's going to wake up in the West. I mean, I don't want to drop the bomb here, but I mean, are we really believing there's going to be this moment where, you know, people are all going to wake up to this stuff? Isn't it all in the public now? Can't we see things? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you that it's like a sort of Nirvana fallacy, perhaps, the promised land thing. One day the public will wake up. I know, but the public are not they're not active agents. They don't. I don't think they really have much agency. What the course of this year would indicate that they're extremely easy to lead and mislead. Mm. So I don't really think we need them to wake up, or indeed I don't really think we want them to wake up, because they're not used to making decisions at this level, you know, about how society should go. They don't. The 95% of people have no idea about this stuff. So that's not what we need. But here's a question for you, and this comes from the comment thread. It was relevant to what we were saying a couple of minutes ago.
Sure.
The elites can get free money anytime they want by printing it. This devalues the currency, but makes them richer. So that's kind of the point that I was trying to make earlier, that I didn't want to use the phrase printing money, but it does seem to be a solution that they're happy to go for.
Printing money is not what I meant by infinite money.
No, but it's kind of what I meant by it.
Yeah, okay, so pardon me, then I misinterpreted. Yeah, so they've been able to print money for a really long time right now, and what that means is that our elites have the ability to overcome temporary liquidity traps, which no one else does. So we're trapped by debt, right? If I incur a huge cost right now, which seems to be pretty regular, considering, you know, I'm starting a family, right? I have to eat that, right? But the elites, through the printing of money, can take momentary liquidity faults and simply transfer that to a future obligation.
Exactly.
And as such, our elites are flexible to an extent that no other elite before them has been flexible. But this does not mean that they have infinite money. They eventually have to pay those obligations or be credible enough to seem like they could pay those obligations. Otherwise, they're not going to be printing anything that anyone considers to have value.
Well, yes. And I guess that because, you know, if you're thinking about a human farm where with pods and people, a person in each pod, and they're just getting, you know, they're plugged in, they're getting a constant supply of stuff. Who's going to pay for that, right? As you know, leaving aside the moral questions, who's going to pay for it? And I guess the real question is, in the future, how is money going to be made? It might well be that having all these people in pods just isn't necessary. It's more in the interests of power to just get rid of them, because it's just human eaters. They're just eating up supplies.
I think a lot of elites have already decided that they don't want to have any more humans.
Yeah, they want far fewer humans.
They want far fewer humans. That's one of the, I mean, this is sort of, we're getting into the scary dimension of this, right? But I guess
to do this on Christmas Eve to everyone.
It's not Christmas Eve yet. Well, I guess it is Christmas Eve where you are. It's not Christmas Eve where I am.
Yeah.
Right. Sorry again.
You don't have a guilty conscience then. Go for it.
Well, I mean, Christmas Eve is supposed to be a day of fasting. I will remind people. My family always used to eat fish on Christmas Eve, which I think most Catholics did, at least in Eastern Europe. But I'm sorry. I'm digressing. So I guess here's my challenge to people like Endeavor. Reactionary theory postulates that you do not need to have pernicious actors in order to explain what's going on right now. It does not say that there are not pernicious actors. I think that's a key distinction that we need to make before we move on, right? Like, there very well might be pernicious actors in this. My next follow-up question to Endeavor is, since I don't believe you need pernicious actors to make pernicious behavior a thing, why does it matter? We need to come up with a reaction to what's going on, regardless of whether this is caused by basically incompetent leaders managing an institution that they've mismanaged and don't want to admit they've mismanaged, or whether this is actually due to specifically, as Endeavor believes, whether this is due to specifically ethnically pernicious attitudes on behalf of some elite actors. To me, the result is going to be the same. The way that their actions are going to be the same. The actions are going to be treating the citizens of the West and soon the citizens of the world increasingly as if they're liabilities, not stakeholders in the future. And then successively bleeding out power so that they can keep themselves in charge for as long as possible, hoping that they can decrease the power of the population faster than they themselves are declining.
God, that's depressing.
I know it's depressing. But you see, the thing is, what the Western leaders, what it seems to me that they're trying to do is they don't want to be supplanted. So if the West declines faster than their ability to maintain power is obviously declining, then there will never be a successor ideology to them. until the entire apparatus collapses, right?
Yeah. But you think that the entire apparatus is going to collapse?
Well, the entire apparatus is not sustainable. Like, do we agree on that? To me, it doesn't seem
sustainable. Oh, I agree. I'm not disagreeing with anything that you're saying. I'm just sort of exploring the ideas.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not making any... Look, I need to make this clear. I'm not, like, looking into some crystal ball here. All I'm doing is taking principles and trying to apply them to the situation. If something's not sustainable, as The Economist once said, it wasn't Keynes, I forget who it was, but if something isn't sustainable, then it must at some point stop, right?
Yeah, that which can't go on forever won't.
Yeah, exactly. So this must at some point crash, and it seems like it's the collapse is kind of metastasizing. Now, that could still be a really long time before we eventually hit the bottom, but what we're essentially seeing with our leaders currently, it's like basically an incompetent CEO trying to make sure that they don't hire any competent managers, because then there would be an option to replace him.
Yes, and they would find a bad situation. If they did, if he did hire competent managers, they would realize that the screw-up that he's made of things.
Exactly. And that's... And I know this is different than Endeavor's analysis, but my question is, regardless of whether it's my metastasizing decline that we've seen in many other institutions and societies, or whether it's Endeavor's pernicious actors, the actions of the elite and the actions of a pernicious group of actors will be the same. This is what's called Robert Conquest's third law. Are you aware of that?
No.
I'm
aware of his laws, but I don't know what they are.
The first one is that everyone's conservative or right wing about the things that they love. The second one is that institutions persistently go left. And the third one is that over time, any institution's leadership will eventually start acting like a conspiracy against the people who the institution is supposed to serve.
Right. Okay.
And this is not designed for our current situations. It was designed to describe organizations generally. And it's exactly what we're seeing right now. And what I'm saying to Endeavor, or to all people here, right, is people, it will look, regardless of whether it's decline or a conspiracy, it will look like a conspiracy. But the question that puts itself in front of us, though, is how do we deal with this? And I think that what's needed is just a radically different way of thinking about politics and thinking about counter-progressive politics. And for instance, this is an example. I'm not a very big fan of BitChute. It's always every year we do this, and every year it's about to like have a big breakout. It never does. And that's because there's a certain number of limitations with the model that Twitter and YouTube have created. BitChute is essentially trying to do YouTube over again, but with less institutional support, which doesn't seem like it will work. The eventual solution is going to be something like PureTube or Mastodon, which is essential, or Urbit, which is a totally distributed social networking system where you basically have common protocols and you have completely independent servers communicating with each other across these common protocols, using crypto technology to essentially keep the data more or less free from hacking, so to speak.
Right. Well, I don't want to get into a discussion about
this
or that platform. Go on.
But my point is that so to my mind, those new technologies are what's going to solve our censorship problem, not alternatives like BitChute. And this is just why I say this only by means of creating an analogy to say that I think the way we're going to defeat the progressives is going to be thinking larger and thinking longer term than the progressives and playing politics in different ways. It's not going to be beating up them at their own game. There is no way we're ever going to yell louder than left Twitter. And there's no way that we're ever going to do a rhetorical frame game more cynically than Destiny or Vosh. And cynicism wins rhetorical frame games eventually. Especially if you have one side being censored, which we are.
Well, exactly. I mean, we're playing on their turf.
Yeah.
I tend to agree with you about that. I don't know about whether we can build our own platforms, but I do take the point that BitChute does not have the institutional support that because it's a famous thing that each of these platforms doesn't, like Twitter doesn't make a profit. YouTube runs at a huge loss every year and always has done. It's known.
They're done to maintain power. In industry, market share, which is the same as power, right?
Yeah. So that is true. I mean, you see, this gets us to what I was going to talk about earlier, which is you were saying that how we don't have political formulas that work. I said it's because the environment isn't amenable to our political ideas, our narratives. And whereas the left have very skillfully brought that situation about through slow colonization, the march of the institutions, but also the march through public life, not just the institutions themselves, but the culture as well. The overall public culture has been colonized to the point where people would be baffled if we weren't awash with narratives facilitating the left. I mean, people would be baffled if that weren't the case suddenly. So I agree. And I think that, I mean, I think that what we need is to create new institutions. I think it's not, of course, we want political formulas, but first you have to have power. I mean, that's the thing. I don't really think that political formulas work on their own. I mean, in the 60s, they were facilitated by popular culture, which was bent in a certain way. Pop music and so on, and Hollywood, and then the new generation of Hollywood in the 70s, and so on and so on. How does that happen? Some people have the reins of power.
I'm going to disagree with you here, because I think I would put it this way. Institutions are built on political formulas by individuals. I think maybe this is a chicken and the egg problem, and there certainly is a degree of that, right? But
to look at it is that it's cumulative. It's self-reinforcing after a certain point.
Yeah, I mean, so for instance, at some point, you know, at some point the new left was, in 1946, the new left, or that didn't really exist, but let's say in 1960, the new left was new and it was on the out, right? It didn't have institutional support yet. But what they were able to do is a variety of individuals were able to discover certain dynamics that worked for them, right? And they were able to build institutions and conquer institutions on the backs of these formulas. And so to my mind, you build political institutions on the back of formulas that work, just like you build corporations on the back of business models that work. The two components that are needed are individuals, as Keith Woods likes to say, high agency individuals or whatever, right? You know what I mean, right? Individuals that
you can get things done.
Yeah, can get things done. And then you have to have they have to notice circumstances and advantages that are being not exploited, that are not being addressed. I don't know how to do this yet, but if when I look at the world that we live in, I think there's such a hunger for healthy, normal human reality. I desire stories about healthy individuals, healthy families, healthy romances that aren't inundated with politics. I wonder if I'm not the only one.
It's so funny you say that, because just the other night I was watching something with a friend, and it was from 1968. And it was just so nice to see people, just normal people. Everyone was heterosexual. Mm-hmm. Everyone was white. All the main characters are male, and they're just doing, they're getting work done. They're doing a job, a mission. And I thought, God, it's so strange to see that now. From the vantage point of 2020, if this thing were made now, that character would be gay, that character would be a black woman, that character would be trans. And it wouldn't be a bunch of men getting on with something and putting their emotions aside in order to get the job done, and putting their petty disagreements with each other aside in order to get the job done. It would be bullshit. It would be emotional, hysterical,
irrational. It's not even emotional bullshit. It's petty political bullshit and jockeying for vindictive rank.
I
get what you're saying, though, right?
In the context of drama, this was a TV drama. I was just talking from that context. You see normal people, because you were saying it would be nice to see stories of just normal people. And I agree, yeah, because it's like, it's so straightforward and simple and idyllic. And it gives you and obviously everyone's weird in their own individual ways. Some people aren't that weird. Some people are very normal. But everyone has idiosyncrasies, whatever. This provided a template for just doing well, just being a good person. Nothing more, you know, wacko or subversive than that. It's just, here are some people doing the right thing, you know? And yeah, it's amazing to see that, because, as I say, nowadays everything is politicized and to the left.
Yeah, this is one of the great poisons of our age, is that everything is politicized. Everything is political. Now, in the sense, everything is political, right? In the broadest sense, the left is right about that, but not everything is politicized. Not everything is supposed to communicate a cute political issue, or is supposed to basically obscure lived realities that you experience day to day for the purpose of putting across a larger political narrative. Personally, I don't see my life reflected in Hollywood at all anymore, and I live a pretty normal life, all things considered. And it's kind of odd, because I mean, I feel like there's a gap there, and this is.
I mean, I don't live a normal life, but it's I'll admit that, but I do understand. I have the same feelings that everyone else does. You know, it would be nice to see a drama that was just about a guy dealing with something. I don't know, stress, for example, just the first thing that comes to my mind. But it could be anything.
Maybe it had to be a little bit more than that. But yeah, I mean, I get where you're going.
Anything. Yeah. Here's a guy dealing with something. Oh, you can identify with that. You can understand that. And here's what happens. That would be a human story, right? Mm-hmm. You couldn't get that. You could not get a drama about that today. Mm-hmm. Or dealing with his ex-wife, or dealing with his kids, or whatever it is, you simply could not have a drama like that now, which was just a human story. It would have to be a politicized. The nearest you'd get would be an LGBT human story, where it's about this gay person's oppressed.
Man, and I don't even remember. Thing. I don't. What's so funny is that the LGBT characters have become less human, just like everyone else. They've become stand-ins for their own political side more and more, experiencers of a life less and less. I think that what we're seeing is just a dehumanization of media. We've gone from the man to the bug man. Obviously, my religion's against homosexuality, and I'm an adherent to my religion, right? But it's almost like that is a detail. That's just a stop on the way to the total removal of human emotion and human lived human experiences that can stand apart from the express narrative that our ruling institutions want to deliver to us.
Yes, absolutely. Everything has become political indoctrination. I mean, this is why I'm very curious to see that Star Trek Discovery two-parter. I'm also very curious to see the new the Doctor Who, the new thing with the woman, because I haven't watched any. I still haven't got around to watching that. I am curious. I know it's going to be an exercise in agony, but I do. I'm morbidly, and I usually avoid it. That's why I don't watch Destiny or Bosch streams. I'm amazed that you can withstand it. I can't do it, but I do want to watch those things just to see how. Apparently, I'm very fond of using the word doctrinaire. Apparently, I use that a lot. Someone said that in the comments earlier, but I am curious to see these things just to see how doctrinaire. Modern entertainment has become, because it's either that or it's just utter bilge, like the DC Comics movies, which are just absolute nonsense.
All the comics movies have just they've been complete train wrecks. They show a craft, but absolutely no soul. And this is just, I don't know. I guess the question is, will people get bored of the Bugman? And I think they will. And that's kind of where I want to be. That's where I'm interested in. And it's very hard to get to specifics, because to get to specific outputs and tactics, you'd have to know what the inputs are going to be. And I'm afraid no one really knows what 2021 is going to look like.
We didn't know what 2020 was going to look like in advance. I mean, this was completely unpredictable, totally unpredictable this year.
I was planning on making 2020 my big in real life networking year. Right. And it totally fell through. Yeah, it totally fell through.
You know, that's in retrospect, that wasn't the best goal to have for this year, was it?
Well, yeah. But, you know, at the same time, I think that's just a necessary thing. I think in my experience, there's been some limitations on the online thing. Right. But in real life got canceled in 2020. And what real life is going to be reinstated in 2021 is still, I think, up for debate. We'd have to know the minds of people like I think we all know the mind of Joe Biden, and that's, you know, somewhere in the ashtray, you know, but we need to know the mind of Vice President Harris to get a good idea of what that's actually going to mean.
And possibly also certain, unofficial powers in like the mind of Klaus Schwab, for example.
Well, you know, in a sense, right? You know, his mind will filter down to the minds of our leaders at some stage, right? Through some mechanism,
maybe via a tube.
Hopefully not yet. I honestly don't know. To me, 2021. I felt for a while, and I haven't, you know, my video making has slowed down in the last few months, because I felt like I've really struggled with what the actual political circumstances are that we're living in. The dynamic is shifting so quickly. I'm not so sure really what to say in the immediate term. The only thing I can say is I just can't believe that anybody looks at the kind of thing that left produces, either in terms of community or just the people that they produce. I can't think anyone is happy with that. They seem to produce broken individuals who are set on living as adult children for the rest of their life. And not only good adult children, living adult children who have radical dopamine addictions and who never go outside.
You know, a weird thing that's just occurred to me is that the kind of people that the left produces today are just awful to, I mean, even to behold. You know, they're physically disgusting. It's some fat feminist covered in crap tattoos and horrible problem glasses and the stupid haircut and all that. Mm-hmm. And if you think just back to, and I'm sorry to keep invoking the 90s, I've done that quite a lot recently on Millennial, but if you look back to the left in the 90s, it was actually quite sexy. I mean, it was still, you know, quite skinny, cool, casual. You know,
or manly, like Kurt Cobain was manly, right?
Perhaps. Yes.
This is relatively speaking, right?
Relatively to today, yeah. And it's weird how quickly it's fallen from that to just these monsters, these reprobates that represent the left today. It's awful. And I wonder why that is. Why is that, that the left? Because you would think that it would look good, but instead this thing that we're supposed to admire and aspire to, and be impressed by, and be indeed led by in some cultural sense, is patently ugly and unpleasant.
I mean, that's sort of an indication that it's not winning at a deep level. It's winning at an exterior level. It's winning at a macro political level. And indeed, the right has taken huge setbacks this year. I don't think we've fully taken stock of the amount of large setbacks we've seen. But the type of people that are produced by the left, at least publicly, is this an indication that something is fundamentally unhealthy about what they are and what they're doing? And I don't think unhealthy things can really thrive in any meaningful way. In the long run, it's not a workable model.
Yeah, I mean, the word degenerate exists and is perhaps overused, but it does mean to degenerate. It means something that has degenerated. It means something that has gone bad. It's gone rotten. It's given into its worst drives and has been disintegrated by them or downgraded by them. And there's only so much of that any organism can stand, even a cultural, social organism.
Yeah, I think that this, to my mind, and this, I think I'm sort of on the same page as the Franklin on this one, the results of a new political formula on the right have to come from this dynamic. And this is where I kind of return to always, is that the vision of the right has to envision a future in which healthy people can exist and thrive, and where we're encouraged to be the healthier self. And I think this is something that the left is sort of moving away from. And I can't imagine that we're going to get into 2022 and not have a lot of people on the left currently. Maybe you disagree with me this. I think that we're going to see a lot of defection of leftist elites in 2021 and 2022. I think a lot of them were kept on board because of Trump, and they're going to start asking a lot of uncomfortable questions. I know that the right can't do this because it's essentially shattered, but whatever is going to be called the right in the future is going to consist of common narratives and common political formulas that can unify these people and lead them towards the production and creation of some future where it's easier to have a family and to care about a community and to care about a culture and an ethnicity, whether that's a new ethnicity or an older ethnicity, because both are being destroyed. It's going to make it easier to live in a country and not a staging area for global capital. And maybe in the process, it's going to make it harder for people to have careers on OnlyFans and to be Twitch political streamers who play video games and yell at the screen all day long. it's going to have to, at some point, the family is going to have to win over the Ethot and the Bugman. Or the human race is extinct, because everyone knows that the Ethot and the Bugman are specimens of the human race that are going to self-exterminate themselves, both on a collective and sometimes on an individual level. Although I don't want to wish ill on my enemies ever, but we know that's a statistical reality. And so if the human race is to survive, it cannot be through the production of these two types of people. It has to be through the production of something different, something that probably looks more like the individual did before the mid-20th century, but may include new things as well. And I think that is the task of the right. That is all of our tasks who want to not follow this down this rabbit hole down to the end.
I would say that I agree with you for sure. We should be looking at the creation of new cultures and new ideas, new ways of living and new ways of seeing ourselves, new ways of seeing the circumstance of being human. I think we actually do need something that drastic, something that radical, because the left have put their own radical alternatives in place there. So we need to combat that with something equally profound. I would also say this is going to be a long-term process. I mean, you just said there are 2021, 2022. That's by then parts of the left will begin to break away because the bogeyman of Trump is no longer there to keep them with solidarity. That, I would say, is quite optimistic. I'm not saying that you're wrong. I'm just saying let's not get our hopes up that we'll see tangible disintegration of our opponents that quickly.
Yes, I agree. But what I'm looking for is not sort of, I hate using the word NPC, but it describes the kind of person. And it was really very apparent in 2020, the NPC personality. I think some previous individual on one of your streams mentioned this, that the NPC seemed to be alive and well in 2020, even though he's a meme from 2018.
Yes, that right? was Martin Lichtmas.
But the contest of the type of politics we're discussing now is a contest that's played among a very small set of people. This is a contest of visions and of aesthetics, and it's not that I think that a lot of people are on the left because the left are the people who are in power and they're the people who have narrative control. And if you want to be one of the good people, you're on the left, right? And a lot of people, they just want to be one of the good people. They just want to own the chuds, as they say, and feel good about themselves while they play video games and watch the third or fourth wave of COVID restrictions come down on their locality. But those people are not the people who are actually playing the game of what might actually replace an organizing vision of the West and indeed the entire human race after our current visionaries, the World Economic Forum and the NGO and the Davos said, once their vision is shown to be a fraud, and I do believe it showing itself to be a fraud on a daily basis, that game is played by elites, basically. And I don't mean like you have to go to some kind of Ivy League or something, but I'm saying that you have to have an amount of a contemplative nature and a desire to engage in that beyond kind of the satisfaction you get from seeing people owned on YouTube or hearing your own views repeated back to yourself. And those are the people that I think Biden is particularly at risk of losing. There are a lot of people who are very, very thoughtful, who didn't like Trump's style on the left and were kind of carried along with this because they kind of believe that they didn't really believe this, but they were kind of humoring their compatriots because the other guy was in office. Well, now he's not. It only takes a small group of defectors on the elite to make a big difference in how the narratives go and the possibilities that are available imaginatively to people who are on your political side, broadly speaking. And I think that's an opportunity.
Well, it certainly is. I also think another point to make here is that something has been established with this election. I don't mean about the... than I had to put this, something has been inaugurated with this election, which is, and I don't care about the question of how it was won. That's irrelevant to the point that I'm going to make here. It looks like if things go as we're predicting here, it looks like Biden's going to be the next president of America. He's going to be in the White House. Kamala Harris is his vice president. Then that means that something has been inaugurated, which is basically that social justice, progressivism is the way of the future. And so the last, basically I'm saying that things are going to move forwards now because the last, white guy, right-wing capitalist Christian guy, he's been ousted now. And that means a certain era is over. So that means that era can now be recreated, or in a new way. I mean, I don't mean recreated,
I'm not so sure.
Exactly. Well, what I mean is, now that the thing is dead, it can be born again, basically.
Yeah, you mean Trump, basically?
Not Trump. I just mean what he represents, or what we hoped he would represent.
Yeah, I guess to my mind, the problem with Trump is the problem with populism generally. First of all, we're using the means of grabbing power that, first of all, our enemies expect
Let me just clarify what I mean. What you and I would call a sane way of living, which is not LGBT madness, not multicultural madness, not atheistic nihilism, just a sensible way of living. What we thought was the last chance to achieve that was with Trump. That is, or the last chance, the last way to salvage that, to save it, was with Trump. That's now over. And I think that might actually turn out to be an advantage, because we can let go of it and now recreate it. That's what I mean.
Yeah.
A sane way of living. In other words, once it's been lost, now you can actually regain it.
Yes.
Paradise regained, let's say.
And at no point, and I think the assertion by people like Vosh that somehow he or the other people who are lifestyle, quote unquote, distance, they're under the thumb of some conspiracy of evangelicals. I think that narrative is going to start dying. I think Trump is really the last breath of that. It's their last attempt to pretend that the right wing culturally has some kind of power over them.
Yes, yes, exactly. And so people like Vosh and all of these awful left wing activists, that they have now got what they wanted. They have now secured the victory that they craved, and the defeat over the right that they craved. Then now they're on the chopping block. They've reached the summit. The only way is down.
Yeah, well, they haven't reached their summit yet, but increasingly people are going to be asking, okay, so who's in charge? Who's calling normal normal and abnormal abnormal? And increasingly, the left is going to have to own this. They're going to have to own this because, well, they are literally purging people for deviating from their philosophy. And if you're Vosh or Destiny, you essentially have been part of that apparatus. You know, you've been part of that apparatus. You've defended that apparatus. And portraying yourself as some kind of dissident against a consensus of some type or another, I don't know. I think it's increasingly going to be very, very stale. I don't think it's going to work. And I think in that process, a lot of people, a lot of inquisitive people will be looking around for some other organizing philosophy. And I think that's the great opportunity that we have in the next few years.
I agree. And I would emphasize that I don't believe this is going to be a short-term process. When I say that, you know, it sounds quite optimistic what I just said, but I don't think it is. I think it'll be generations. I'm just saying that I think the process starts now. And
Yeah, absolutely. We can't wait.
Oh, no, absolutely not. But also, I don't think that, because someone just posted in the YouTube live chat, Texas turns blue in 2024, prepare accordingly. What would you say about that?
Well, I mean, we know that the Democrats are going to have demographic dominance. I think, you know, there's one problem with their great plan is they've seen now that their demographic dominance, it's eventual, but it's going to be a little bit softer than they imagined. They're basically by importing people from Mexico or South America, they're not importing SJWs. They're importing people that kind of support them, but are entirely unenthusiastic. And what really lies ahead of them, you know, I guess I just ask this. I mean, I think that it's very well that the Republican Party is dead. The question is, if you're a right winger, your question is, how does some political apparatus come into being that sees me more as a stakeholder than the Republican Party did? If you notice one thing about being part of the Democratic Party as a stakeholder, and that's you get paid, you get respected, That's something that was really never given to the ethnicities that were represented by the Republican Party. The only people who got paid by the Republican Party were their, basically their millionaire donors that got tax cuts. And so I want to say, you absolutely have a death of the Republican Party coming up. And you absolutely have the ascendancy of the Democratic Party. But A, that ascendancy is not going to be as lockstep as the Democrats imagined. And B, this opens up narrative problems and political problems that I think right-wingers can exploit to essentially get a representative at some level of power that will actually have their interests at heart.
Yes. Yeah, indeed. I mean, that's what we need to aim for at this point. Something that nebulous, but laudable.
Well, I mean, like, there's not going to be a patriotic alternative in America. I don't even know what patriotic alternatives election prospects are. But there's not going to be some kind of party like that in America going forward. No opposition to the mainstream Democratic Party can be that monopolar. Not only because our political system is different, but because those kind of monopolar attacks are exactly the kind of attacks that the Democratic Party is designed to destroy and also uses to augment its own narrative control over the constituencies that make it up. So I really think that in America, we need to have a radical out-of-the-box thinking when it comes to alternatives to progressivism and alternatives to communism.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, we'll move on to questions now.
Sure.
I think this has been a very interesting talk, but I don't want to keep you up all, well, earlier for you, but I don't want to keep myself up.
Yeah.
All right, because it is nearly 4 a.m. here. So.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry.
Don't worry. I enjoy it.
There were basically two. I had a vision of this conversation, and there's basically two ways we could do this. There could be like the intense, what's the future of the right wing way, and there can be kind of the more laid back, shooting the moon over personalities way. And I think I opted for the more intense topic of conversation. So hopefully we can wind down a little bit here.
Exactly. I think we did start intense, but that was good. And yeah. That was what I wanted. And I think it's what the viewers wanted as well. But we'll have some. So if people can post their questions on Entropy now, that'd be great. I don't think there have been any on DLive. So I've got somebody looking out for them on DLive, and none have been posted. But Entropy is preferable. But anyway, go for it. So, okay, here's one. I don't know what the Lincoln Project is, but someone says, can a based equivalent of the Lincoln Project be a model for future right-wing organization?
Isn't Lincoln Project a bunch of anti-Trump Republicans?
I don't know.
Lincoln Project is an American, blah, 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 is an American political action committee by number of Republicans and former Republicans. It aimed to prevent the re-election of Donald Trump and defeat all Republicans in close races. I guess what he's saying is he sees the Lincoln Project as a project that effective, but
I think he's a kind of based equivalent of the Lincoln Project, be a model for future right wing organizations. So the way that it was, the way that it operated, presumably, is what he's talking about.
Well, I'm not so sure about the specifics. I guess the big problem right now is that the Republican coalition is, on a national sense, really, really small and weak. And the Lincoln Project had the advantage of being bankrolled by Trump's rich enemies. Some kind of distant right faction is not going to have that, at least not immediately. Any distant right party is going to have some deep pocket allies, be they domestic or foreign, and it has not discovered those yet. So.
Okay. All right.
You don't have to read that latest super chat. And my wife's trolling me.
All right. I won't read it out, but it's just an affectionate message describing the distributist in glowing terms. But it also
the message also is God bless and Merry Christmas.
Yeah, well, yes. So God bless and Merry Christmas to Mrs. Distributist as well. So thank
and there's comments about how we are both attractive individuals as well.
Yes. Yes. But especially you. Of course.
I should hope because she's stuck with me.
Okay. Dave, have you watched many of mid-20th century European non-English films? French, German, Italian? Or are you spiritually closer to David French, famous Marvel movie completist?
Oh, I wish he asked which non-European films he wanted me to watch.
No,
I mean,
no, mid-20th century European non-English.
European, not English. French, German, Italian.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I mean, one of my favorite movies is The Seventh Seal, which certainly qualifies. For a while in high school, I really liked Fellini, you know, that Italian era. I'm trying to think. The problem is there's so many here, right? Like the 400 Blows or stuff like that. I don't know. We'd have to get more specific.
The question was, are you more spiritually close to the Marvel Comics fan or to the art house movie fan?
Oh yeah, that he's referring to the whole David French, how David French just said that he watched every single Marvel movie. And I just kind of had this moment of horror when I looked upon that tweet by David French. It was sort of hard to imagine a kind of a more hollow individual, because you always think of these National Review types as if they're going to be really, really cultured. And apparently David French has kind of got like this inner bug man soul in the body of a boomer. Which is, I'm much more close. I mean, if you want to give me the option between 8.5 and Infinity War, give me 8.5. I would take a surrealist Italian movie any day. And, you know, I'm not necessarily the biggest Fellini fan. That's just the one that's coming to mind right now. But yeah, yes, please. The European stuff. Thank you.
All right, good. I'm relieved. okay. How do you go about trying to explain that COVID isn't as serious as the media says it is to family and normies? Also, loving Millennial this year, it's made my Christmas. Well, thank you very much. I'm glad to hear that. So how do you go about explaining to people that COVID isn't as serious as the media say it is?
Well, I feel kind of conflicted by this because I only got to look at the numbers about a few months ago. And indeed, like, you can see this huge uptick of deaths in the raw data. Now, I'm not so sure what that means yet, right? It is established that the survival rate's fairly high, but the even with a 99% survival rate, that's going to be a hell of a lot of people, right? Especially since our population is so old. I think a lot of times I would avoid the question about whether COVID is in itself deadly. What I've asked my parents' generation, and I never heard a good answer to this, is so what happens if the period between 1955 and 2020 are historically unique? What if our antibiotics start failing and we have a disease like this pretty much every year? Does that mean that we essentially extend these insane, extraordinary powers to the government and to non-governmental institutions indefinitely? Does that mean that my child never gets to go outside in a meaningful way or have a cohort of other children that he plays with? You know, what happens if these antibiotic diseases, resistant diseases, start coming back? They'll have as high a fatality rate as COVID. I suppose that's how I would approach it. A lot of times I'm very suspicious of factually contesting leftist claims when I'm not sure that they've got some problem in their thinking, which happens fairly frequently, even for ideas that ostensibly come out of the university. But a lot of times what leftists do is they take a moral transgression and they try to hide it behind a factual claim that they know they can win. So they won't argue over, they'll argue over some question about, like, you know, whether immigration improves GDP or something like that. That's the bullshit question that the Cato Institute and the Brookings Institute and every liberal think tank or every progressive think tank is going to want to argue with you, right? Because even if it's not true, like even if the minority opinion is true, which I think there's a good case for, that's not the relevant question with mass immigration. The relevant question for mass immigration is, so you're throwing away all of these other qualities about our culture for GDP. Furthermore, you're taking GDP as representation of consumption, not of well-being. And all while GDP consumption is going up, all these measures of well-being having to do with how affordable it is to start a family, how easy it is to get a wage that can sustain a family, and all these other metrics that we used to think were more valuable are being hurt at the same time the total consumption is elevating. So really, most of the time, your objections to the left are values-based, not fact-based. But the left will always try to tempt the right wing to digress into a factual contention that they can drop 50 studies on, because the amount of studies that support the left, even when they're wrong, is going to be much, much higher than the amount of studies that they go against it. This is why Bosch and Destiny's model works.
Yeah, and perhaps the right is going to need to learn to be that devious.
Is it devious, though? What we're saying is that there's a bigger question involved here, right?
Oh, yeah. But what I mean is that they are prepared to fund studies that will then back up the arguments that they want backed up.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, you've ever seen Vosh? I mean, I know you don't watch Vosh, but you know he's argued for this, for a bunch of bullshit positions. Like I said, he's argued that trans women have no advantage over biological women in sporting competitions, and he's argued that you could illegalize private businesses and have co-ops replace them. This is not the mainstream view in the academy, but what he does is the left cultivates bullshit. I'm using an engineering term, but have you ever heard of CYA or cover your ass? CYA or cover your ass is essentially a way you shield yourself from blame when it turns out that you're wrong about a prediction or a fact. So this could be a fudge factor. This could be a narrative that explains why it was okay to be wrong or whatever, right? So the left in the universities has built in cover your ass papers for radical activists, even when they go against the consensus of the already progressive university. And so Vaush uses those to deceptively imply in debates that he is speaking from some kind of consensus perspective when it's obvious he's not and he's bullshitting. I just don't think that the right ever benefits from courting lies and deceptions. I think the truth is such a strong ally. And if the right is really not the prefiguration, if the right is truly what it should be, and what the right should be is the prefiguration of a new order, the right should be a prefiguration of a new order using the memories of something in the past that worked, and not some kind of nostalgic hearkening back to a dead society. If it is that, then the right is young and the right should use its youth to dedicate itself to truth and not bullshit.
Nice words. I hope you're right. It's a complicated matter. You're talking about is truth in itself shiny and resplendent and seductive and persuasive?
It's not.
That's the trouble. Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It is if you're rational and concerned with the truth.
Truth is not a political formula, but political formulas die and truth is eternal, right? So if you're a young political entity that has a bright future ahead of itself, you want to build as much as possible the basis of your worldview on truth. Because stuff that's not truth is going to go away after a while. Mm. And And so if you're an old political order, go bullshit it up, right? I mean, you know, because, you know, tomorrow isn't going to exist for you, right? You know, so when people finally figure it out, when people finally figure out, and I don't know why people haven't figured this out, the trans women, you know, who've gone through puberty as men have an advantage over biological women in contests of strength and endurance. You know, if you're around then, that's going to cost you. Obviously, certain people don't think that they're ever going to have to answer that because, you know, the future.
If we win, we should put Vosh into a contact sport with a trans man and just see who wins.
That's comedy, not punishment.
It would be both.
Are we trying to punish the trans man or Vosh, or are we trying to punish both of them?
All right, let's move on because it could be in violation.
Okay, yeah, sorry. My bad.
No, it's me. I started it. All right. If you predict the USA will be progressive for the next several generations, how are we to raise our children to survive and thrive in this situation? Fight and potentially lose our livelihood, or roll over and live? I've just realized that's also from your wife.
This is why personal and political need to be somewhat separated. I don't think that we can live lies, but I also don't think it's necessarily going to be as stark as that. I think that what's going to happen is that we're going to have to endure temporary economic hardship. So I guess I'm starting with the economic side of the question. I think that we're going to have to endure temporary economic hardship before the ruling class in this country identifies a problem that's more important than punishing right-wingers. I hope that next step of the culture war is going to come sooner rather than later. As for raising children, to raise children, you need to essentially raise them in a peer group. Peer group controls political opinions. That's the fundamental question. It's the fundamental reality of children. And their peer group is comprised of their parents, to some degree their teachers, but most importantly, groups of young people who they associate with and who they do leisure with. And so what I would like to see more than anything else is are groups of right-wing people who do leisure together. And then I have no idea how this is going to work post-COVID because we have no idea what post-COVID looks like even at this stage. But for both children and for adults, homeschooling is essential, and I think that the work done there is necessary, and we need to solve the economy of scale problem on homeschooling. But after homeschooling, the next step is how do we create right-wing spaces for leisure? And I'm amazed. I mean, obviously, there's no profit in right-wing spaces for leisure, which is probably why they don't exist yet. But more than anything else, I want them personally, right? And a good design for a business model is always – a good sign that you have a good business model is always that you personally want it yourself.
Yes. Okay. Someone says about our previous – Super Chat, it was about how do you go about persuading people about COVID, and he's provided a PDF, a meta study from October, and it says overall the infection fatality rate is 0.23%, but for working age adults it's 0.05%. 1 in 2,000 people who get COVID will die. For working age adults, 1 in 2,000 people.
That could be true, but the high overall death rates could be driven. This is why, do you want to, I'm tempted here to digress into a nuanced statistical discussion because I haven't had much time, but I've been trying to dabble in these statistics, and I'm basically trying to make that number work with the overall death count number that's coming from the raw data and the CDC. And I'm not going to lie. I'm searching for a narrative that makes those numbers make sense. My question is, are you having this nuanced statistical discussion with your parents? I mean, really, like, is that what this is really about? Like, how we do Bayes' rule properly to make that low death rate match up with the high overall deaths for 2020? Yeah. Like, we're sitting down with like a math problem and like a whiteboard, and we're trying to make, you know, the equations balance. I don't think that's what's actually going on. The real question is, do you want a disease that has a historically normal death rate be a tool for unending political power for people we don't trust? The answer has to be no. Otherwise, a return to historical normalcy in terms of disease death rates, which I know was historically, by the standards of 1955 to 2020, incredibly high, hands all successive history over to a bunch of people that are either outright malicious or outright incompetent. And I don't rather care which one it is.
Right. Okay. Okay. There was one other one. I've posted that PDF in the live chat just in case anyone is curious about it. Now here's a good one. Who is doing better long-term planning right now? Nick Fuentes and America First, or the SSPX and their Catholic commune in St. Mary's, Kansas? And SSPX is the Society of St. Pius X.
Yeah, they're Latin Mass Catholics. And wherever they come up, I always wonder why FSSP doesn't also come up, because FSSP is like SSPX, but without the accusations of heresy between them and the mainstream church, right?
Right.
They're the loyalist versions of the SSPX.
Okay.
So Nick Fuentes is big, you know, is, as far as I'm concerned, to use my previous, like the previous things I brought up in the stream, Nick Fuentes' big achievement over the last 2 years has been able to, he's pointed out that we have a winning political formula against normie conservatives and traditional Republicans. And by all means, that's a winning political formula. Every time you repeat that, you win. So by all means, guys, milk the hell out of that. The problem is that normie Republicans are dying anyway. And so, you know, so that formula in isolation is not going to be enough to macrocosmically get you where you want to be. But I compliment Nick Fuentes for realizing that weakness and that narrative dynamic existed and exploiting the hell out of it. And I think to the extent that we can still play that card, we should. After 2021, are opportunities like that going to abound with a Republican Party that might be dead on arrival anyway? Who knows? But that's a great thing. Ultimately, I think the answer to this question has to be that, you know, I'm going to treat this question more broadly, so I'm not talking about out-and-out heretics. Traditionalist Catholics planning for the long term are the future. Not just traditionalist Catholics, all traditional peoples planning for the future are long term, where one of the constituencies we have to draw strength from. Nick Fuentes is a very clever man, and I hope he comes out with good political insights in the future. But I think fundamentally that's more short term, as I think it's intended to be, right?
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure what Nick Fuentes is trying to achieve, and I don't want to speak for him, but it seems to chop and change quite a lot. You see, he and I had a beef 3 years ago.
Well, I do too with him. I don't know why. I don't even know why we disagree. All I know is that his followers don't like me, and I have no idea why. I guess it's in some Twitter thing that happened on Twitter. I must have counter-signaled something he was doing.
Right, okay.
Who knows?
They can be very loyal.
Yeah. I have no beef with him. I want to make that very clear. Right,
right, right.
I think he was able to score a point on the Republicans and the normie conservatives. Great. And I hope he continues to do that. And I think his ambitions are to replace the Republican Party, but I'm not so sure that we know what needs to replace the Republican Party. Right? Do you know what I'm saying? Right? In order to replace the Republican Party, we would need to have a better developed understanding of what the future should look like. And our understanding of that is just beginning to come into focus, in my opinion.
Yes, indeed. And that's something that a huge amount could be said about that. But let's leave it for now. One last question. This is from Eki Lux, who's been very active in the live chat. The left, I'm just saying that just because I know that you're acquainted with them. The left has gone anti-reality, health, nature. The right could claim to be pro-health, reality, etc. But I think we need something metaphysical. Eastern Orthodox is gaining lots of converts. Possible path here?
Well, I think all Christianity is really the possible path here. We definitely need something metaphysical, because I don't think, you know, going pro reality, right, is it's going to expose the left as hypocrites. It's going to disrupt their narrative. But and this is what people have understood is calling the left hypocrites doesn't really make a difference. Because the big problem that we're dealing with right now is not that the left are hypocrites, but that there is no right wing that we can really believe in, either because it's too weak or because it has so much baggage or unsavory individuals associated with it that it's not anything that's worthy of believing in. So I would say that by all means, harp on the fact that the left is anti-reality and anti-health, but in order for you to gain any kind of benefit from pointing this out, you're going to need to have a vision of the future, and that's going to need to have a metaphysics associated with it. I think that is going to, in large part, be born from Christianity. I believe that the flavor of this Christianity is going to have, it's going to be basically, it's not going to be something that destroys denominations in theological perspective, but I believe that this new approach to human life it's going to be something that's going to be embraced across a variety of different Christian denominations, and may even include some religions on the periphery that are not Christian who will want to participate in this new political vision of what a human should be in the post-industrial age. And, you know, that's what I really hope for. I see the Orthodox Church doing good work, but I really don't think that they're the only Christians doing good work. I just think that they're the ones that are the best politically organized to take advantage of this particular situation, because the base of their support is not caught up in Western boomers. The Catholic Church and the Protestant Evangelical Church have a big, big problem right now, because their political leadership all came of age in an environment that was thoroughly postmodern, and they've taken on all sorts of bad political instincts. And as we know about church politics, it's very, very slow to change. And so I don't think that the problems in the Catholic or Protestant denominations are going to be solved, and probably for a good long time. And that thought really, really depresses me. It causes me a lot of grief personally. But solved they will be eventually. And I do believe that the Catholic Church, if not most Protestant flavors, will emerge at the end of whatever crisis we're going through with a new understanding and a new way of communicating their eternal message. So I hope that answers the question.
All right. I just realized I didn't complete what I was saying earlier about Nick Francis.
Go ahead, yeah.
Now he and I had a beef 3 years ago. And so I've got to be careful what I say, because I know that things get back to him. And I don't want people to say, oh, Woz has still got this beef with him 3 years later, because I don't. But I know that things get misconstrued. So, I've got nothing against the guy. I just find it difficult to follow what's going on with that, because it's such a fast-moving train, the America First thing. There's no animosity from... Hold on, I'm just going to say that there's no animosity from me. That's all I want you to say.
Oh yeah, I make a point never holding grudges unless someone has totally personally betrayed me, which has happened a few times actually on the internet, weirdly enough.
Oh yeah, it's not weird to me.
I can imagine. I don't want to comment on personal things, but from what you've told me, I certainly believe that.
Yeah. Well, on that note, I want to end this one because I'm exhausted.
At this point.
I'm struggling to keep up with the questions, or rather with your answers to the questions. This has been a fantastic one, and I think it's been a very long one as well, 2 hours long.
Sorry about that.
No, not at all. It's been fascinating. Is there anything else you'd like to say before we finish?
I'll let you get some rest. And now, let's say this, though, Woz. Whenever this millennial's over, we really should just have a conversation online during ordinary time. It would be, I think it would be interesting to do some catch-up streams and see where you are at when we enter into this great unknown country that's called 2021 that no one really has an understanding what's going to be in that mystery box, right?
Yeah, that might be a good thing to do, actually. That might be a good way to deliver some of my ideas.
Yeah, absolutely.
I am, very open to that, certainly. All right, excellent. Yeah. Well, this was the ninth night of Millennial 2020, and this was the Distributist. As I said, he's always one that people ask for, and I always enjoy speaking to him. So I think this has been a good one. Yeah. So thank you very much for appearing on Millennial 2020.
Thank you very much for having me, Millennial Woz.
Excellent. All right. I'll be back tomorrow night. I should just say who's going to be on tomorrow. Now, we're starting with Thomas Baden-Rees, then Frode Midyard, because this is Christmas Eve, so I wanted to go fairly easy with the guests. So it's Thomas Baden-Rees, then Frode Midyard, then Charlemagne, and then Travis LeBlanc. And reading those, I realized that I really didn't manage to go easy with the guests, because those are all going to be quite engaging discussions. I should say that Travis LeBlanc is a writer at Countercurrents who has never done a live stream, and he says to me that he's never going to do another one. So this will be a unique opportunity for people to hear Travis LeBlanc in conversation. So
I'm pretty sure I've heard some of his pieces, although I can't quite put my finger on one. The name definitely is very familiar.
Yeah, he's quite a name. So that should be interesting. So I'm looking forward to that. All right. On that note, let's end the ninth night of Millennial. It's going well, but I'm exhausted. So I'm going to end it there.
Right, get some sleep, Woz.
All right. Thank you, and I'll see you all tomorrow night. Bye for now.